weekend at 9 o'clock. This is KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Stay tuned now for Swing Shift. And a hearty good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Boy, it's a pleasure to be back up in Boulder again. It's been a while. This is Dave Gloss with Swing Shift this evening, and the reason why I'm up here in Boulder this evening is because I have some very special guests to talk to you this evening about a wonderful new collection of Tommy Dorsey memorabilia that has been donated to the University of Colorado. And we have some very special guests to talk about that. Tom Reese and Brian Casey and my friend Barbara Dorsey. So we'll be with you in just a minute. Longtime listeners of this show may recall that I started this process about, believe it or not, 39 years ago when I started this broadcast of Swing Shift on Saturday evenings. And while I was attending the University of Colorado back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, I was very much involved with the Glenn Miller Archive, which our friend Alan Cass was so much a part of for so many years and still is. A wonderful fella who I spent a lot of time with, and I think I was his only volunteer back in those days. But nevertheless, that kind of was an impetus to a lot of bigger and better things happening that I'd like Tom Reese to discuss now in regard to the University of Colorado and its American Music program.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be here
this evening and to talk about the AMRC. It took me a while just to get those initials in order, American Music Research Center. For the first year, people kept saying, what does he do? The American Music Research Center was actually the brainchild of an amazing woman, a Dominican nun, as a matter of fact, in San Rafael, California. And as Sister Mary, as we affectionately knew her, was nearing her retirement in the late 1980s, actually. She came into contact with several folks from CU, and ultimately, of course, all of her materials, which had been lovingly collected. She was a concert pianist who discovered all the varieties of American music in the midst of her teaching career. And anyway, in short order, a group of individuals in Boulder thought, wow, this would be a terrific addition to what was already the growing Glenn Miller collection, as well as other materials by local composers, performers, individuals, and groups. And thus the AMRC came to Boulder And it was actually started in 1967. So this year marks its 50th year of existence, the oldest American music research center in the country, as a matter of fact. In any case, came to Boulder in the late 80s, early 90s. I was hired in 1992 to direct, help with, form. I wasn't quite sure. I just knew they wanted to pay me money and come and talk about American music. And I'd written about African-American show music. I was fascinated by musical theater. I had been classically trained as a cello player. So I was game for whatever was coming down the road. Alan and I made a common cause fairly early in that process and realized that we each had a friend who had an interest that was shared and intense in this part of the world. So from that time to this, there's been a gradual coming together of Alan wanting to consolidate his collections. Of course, he's now retired, and also wanting to make a good home for all of these many collections. We now have some 83, maybe 84 by now, named, labeled collections. And a collection sounds like a wild, crazy, hard to understand thing. But collection is basically whatever some person has collected. And we have everything from materials from Hank Troy, our silent film accompanist, who's still working in Denver. Mm-hmm. A lot of Hank's arrangements. We have materials from another collector, in this case, a Nelson Eddy Jeanette McDonald fan club person in Oregon. I remember driving out to Oregon and speaking to these lovely people and saying, "What exactly would you like to donate to us?" And of course,
singing Indian Love Call all the way.
Exactly. Yeah, that was sort of stuck in my brain. It was going over and over and over again. collections of African-American women composers by Helen Walker Hill, a late professor, but a wonderful friend who taught up in Fort Collins and Laramie for a while, and whose son, Gregory Walker, is actually still active as a violinist in Denver. So there are a lot of Colorado connections amongst the collections, and some that have just come to us for a variety of reasons. We're always in the process of making more and more complete collections descriptions. That's what Brian is engaged in right now with the Walter Scott collection of Tom Dorsey. The Len Miller materials actually consist of five different collections. So it's really quite a long and complex road from, oh, would you like to have our materials, or, you know, Uncle Fred left a box and we don't know what to do with it. Would you be interested? And I've learned the librarians have slapped my hands for the years saying, don't say yes until you find out what it is they've actually got.
Yes.
But in any case, it's always exciting to discover at the detail level, at the page to page, recording to recording, note to note level almost in some cases.
So eventually in this process, of course, you got to know our good friend and Tommy Dorsey's son, mm-hmm. Tommy Dorsey III. And I was wondering how that all tied in, if you could explain that a little bit.
I'm thinking that it might have been in connection with one of the Glenn Miller galas. We had one or two of them back in the late 90s. And I remember it very well because I enjoyed very much having young Tom on the board, on my advisory board. I have a volunteer advisory board, which rotates in new people and occasionally retires folks. And I think Tom came onto the board around that time. And I was probably introduced by Alan, I guess.
Absolutely.
And he probably came to the Glenn Miller Gala. So I think that was probably the beginning of my personal knowledge, other than, of course, having heard my parents, who loved big band music. It was of their generation, of course. But I think that was the initial connection. And Tom was a great board member for probably, I'm thinking probably anywhere from probably 4 to 5 or 6 years. Probably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Barbara, aren't you excited about finding a semi full of your father-in-law's material and finding it here so close by at the University of Colorado?
Well, I'm I am very, very excited. But the thing is, I think I probably have more in my basement.
For years, I was not allowed in the basement of the Dorsey home. So that was a comparatively recent phenomenon. But I don't think any, well, you had to take out an insurance policy first, right, Barbara?
Well, definitely. <I'm
kidding. laughs> So what do you remember about your husband, Tom, becoming involved at CU and being a part of this process?
Well, my Tom was brought up by his father as an athlete. And when those days were over, Tom loved his father's music. I mean, it was, we all did, and we had young children, and that's what we played, and that's the way we lived our lives. It was wonderful.
And through that process, you introduced me to a lot of jazz personalities over the years.
But of course, David. As if I know that many.
Oh, you do, Barbara, or at least they know of you.
Well, I've taken you to a couple jazz parties, and I do know them, and I can introduce you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Dick Gibson, for many years, had so many wonderful jazz parties, and on Labor Day weekend, he would bring in, I believe it was it between 30 and 40. Truly top-notch jazz musicians.
At least.
Yeah. And then he would select members of that organization who had big band experience, and he would put them together in a big band. And I remember the first year I went, I was just stunned by the fact that he had cardboard stands for these people. And I had my own big band at the time, so I painted them up, and I brought them in, and I said, you know, you need to have the proper lights and, you know, all that sort of thing. Well, he was so impressed with that there were only two people that he allowed to watch the rehearsal, and it was I and Tom. And I had known Tom by that time for many, many years. And even though it was a Benny Goodman tribute, they started playing, and I turned over and looked at Tom. And he was wiping his eyes. And I went over to him, and I put my hand on his shoulder. I said, Tom, is everything okay? And he said, you know, I haven't heard a big band play like this since Dad died. And so it was, it was very much a part of your life and certainly your husband's life, and one that remained a lifelong passion for the Dorsey family. So, we have a special recording that's been brought in by Brian here this evening, and I have not heard this, so I'm going to trust him that this is this is what's advertised. But Brian, you want to describe here the first track on the CD you handed me of the Casino Gardens?
I believe this is Tommy Dorsey's orchestra from 1947, the One Night Stand radio show, and this should be, it's listed as the opening. I would imagine it's the theme song.
That wouldn't be too surprising. No. I think we'll all know it.
So yes, let's listen and hear what it
Can
is.
Can we hum along?
Yeah.
One Night Stand. From Tommy Dorsey's beautiful new Casino Gardens in Ocean Park, California, right here over the blue Pacific Ocean, with music by that sentimental gentleman featuring Ziggy Elman and Charlie Schaefer's, the lyrics by Lucy Ann Polk, Stuart Foster, and the Todd Criers. As for me, my name's Vince Williams.
soon may come to me.
I couldn't be happier. I actually haven't heard that before.
I was hoping to find something that would be unique to, yeah. to your show.
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, and of course, I'll Get By As Long As I Have You by Tommy Dorsey from his casino ballroom in just south of L.A., about a half an hour back in those days, towards San Diego. And so, yeah, what a pleasure to hear with vocalist Lucy Ann Polk. I wanted to talk a little bit, Brian, about how you became involved, and maybe, Tom, you can also talk about the acquisition of this Tommy Dorsey collection.
Sure. I'll let Tom address the acquisition of the collection, but I came to Colorado about 4 years ago to engage in the doctoral program in jazz studies at the Thompson Jazz Studies Program. Whose offices are downstairs from the American Music Research Center. So coming into the building, I would always see this sign, American Music Research Center, and I was intrigued by that. And it took some digging around, and it took me about a year to really become engaged with what Tom was doing and what his staff were doing. But since last year, I had the honor of being the Glenn Miller Fellow, which helped support my work in the archives. Now I'm a staff member in the archives, and I've been doing item-level cataloging of this Walter C. Scott collection of Tommy Dorsey materials that are... that the level of completeness in this collection is one of the most remarkable things.
And it's acquisition, Tom?
I really don't have a lot of detail on that. It came in after I arrived. Alan was a pretty eager beaver collector. He was also very careful, I have to say. And one of the things we're grateful for is that he did not just willy-nilly take things. And,
sure.
And but I'm guessing probably these came in around perhaps the time we moved into Mackie, which we have now moved out of, which was around 2000. That's a total stab in the dark. And Alan, if he's listening, can call and correct me on that. We have so much material, particularly connected to Miller and big band music, that, as Brian said, just doing the item level inventory is a Herculean task. And I think this is the thing that, well, particularly in our age of instantaneous, and can I have this now? And you know, you get a phone call and someone says, oh, can you give me some recordings of this, or can I come in and listen to this music? And the answer is, well, call us in, you know, a month, a year, whatever.
Sure.
Because behind all of this wonderful, elaborate collection that we have, of course, are humans who are collecting what librarians call metadata, all the material about, information about the various objects. And this takes lots and lots and lots of time and effort. It's getting there, and we're consolidating all the time, but it's an exciting process, because as Brian again was just suggesting, when you're doing this deliberate kind of piece by piece, you start to think, well, this is special, or this is unique, or that song I've never heard before. And sometimes collections which on the surface seem redundant or not especially interesting, at the bottom of the box, you'll find an item that even the experts start shaking their heads and say, I've never heard this before. I've never seen this piece before. And part of that comes from actually the phenomenon of radio recording or radio broadcasting. I was looking at some transcription just a while ago and realizing that these were kept. Originally, transcription discs were kept. That's what were played over the air for those who don't know that. Were kept for insurance purposes and legal purposes, mm-hmm. so that the cigarette the advertiser, Chesterfield, could call and say, you have to prove to me that you have advertised our cigarettes, you know, enough on the air. And so they would have the discs as a record. Well, as things became digitized and more, we relied more on less on hard records. The transcription just were either shelved or given away or destroyed. Or it's kind of amazing what we don't have. But long story short, the motivation for performing on the radio may have been, here's a popular song today. But they might have been songs that the band itself wouldn't want to record or be able to record commercially.
Right.
And of course, radio transcription discs also include commentary, the advertisements, again, as I say, for legal purposes, and personal references. Again, pieces that where the director just says, okay, boys, let's do this work. We're not going to do it on our concert. We can't do it, but we're going to be on the air tonight, and a caller has called in, or the host of the show has said this is important. It's fascinating, actually, to go through these and discover how many specific items appear in this fashion and that never made it to a commercial recording.
Well, and with Glenn Miller, for example, he recorded virtually everything that the band ever put out on broadcast form because he mm-hmm. felt, standing in the trombone section, he couldn't hear the balance of the orchestra. And the only way that he could hear whether he liked the sound or not was to record it and then listen back to the mm-hmm. to the discs. So, yeah, wonderful, wonderful saga. One of the things that has always intrigued me, and just very briefly, if we could talk about this, but just how small, really, the music industry was back in those years. Everybody knew everybody. They'd played with each other. They came up together. So many of, you know, for example, I was the one that found your What's in the Collection when I first met Mary, which is a horrible tune, but it, nevertheless, it's the first recording of both Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman mm-hmm. From 1926, and you know, one of the things that impressed me in talking to your Tom was that once again, everybody knew everybody. There weren't that many people on a national level that were out there trying to go on the road and all the crazy trips they were taking. And it's amazing anybody survived when you look at some of those schedules. But nevertheless, anybody want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, Brian's actually been a touring musician and jazz musician. He probably has the most current information on well, the road these days.
not even current. Well, coincidentally, I happened to get a call several weeks ago when the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, the legacy, I think the real or the one and only Tommy Dorsey Orchestra,
right.
was in town. They played at BDT Stage. And the day before their show, I got a call from a friend of mine that I was in school with at North Texas, saying, our bass player's bass isn't working. How can we get one? We need one tomorrow night. And I said, oh, well, you know, if it's in Denver, it'll be kind of hard because I didn't know where the show was. And he said, no, we're in Boulder. So I was able to bring him the bass. And the bass player happened to be another acquaintance of mine through kind of the bass, the jazz bass world. So yes, it's still a small kind of closely knit group.
No.
But I mean, from a personal perspective, when Barbara was talking about seeing the Glenn Miller Orchestra under the direction of Tex Beneke, I recall that in my college years, my very first jazz band director was a trombone player who played in the Tex Beneke-led Glenn Miller Orchestra. Yeah. So then I was wondering if maybe Leroy Anderson, the trombone player, was in the band. So I think we all have these connections that overlap and cross each other from time to time.
Well, you know, one of the great stories that your husband used to talk about a lot with me was that his dad had, of course, if it was going to be Tommy Dorsey, it had to be the penthouse suite of the Brill Building in New York City. You had to be on the top floor in Tommy Dorsey's world. But everybody who had, I mean, everybody from the Irving Berlins to the Cole Porters, everybody had their music publishing house in that building. And thank heaven that building is still there. It was funny when I was walking around New York and said, "Oh, that's the Brill Building." I basically stumbled across it, and felt like maybe I should lean that way like millions do towards Mecca, you know. Yeah. But
go up to the top.
I walked past it. I had the same experience. I went back. Oh, this is the Brill Building. There was an aura. I think it was. Yeah. Out. That's where Name Your Person worked and recorded and wrote.
Absolutely. But I think on Tuesdays, if you're an out-of-work musician, you hung out outside the Brill Building, and the band leaders would come by, and they'd say, you know, I need a second tenor, or I need a, you know, this and that. And that's how you got hired. And one of the not so well known stories, but I think it also says a lot about Tommy Dorsey, is he would go down and he would roll up a $50 bill in his hand. Now, this is the 30s and 40s, folks. So a $50 bill was a pretty substantial amount of money. And as he shook the person's hand, the $50 bill would pass to the person, and that way that musician would never have to be embarrassed about accepting the gift. But he would have, in typical Tommy Dorsey fashion, a stack of $50 bills in his pocket and go down and make sure everybody was taken care of. So there's lots of wonderful stories that are not really all that well known. And that's why another thing I'm really hoping, Brian, that you start stumbling across in this vast collection, maybe some things that kind of flush out the personality of.
Sure. I haven't even gotten to the papers of Walter C. Scott, who was an avid collector of Tommy Dorsey material. So I'm sure there are going to be gems and bits of evidence that may help us kind of piece together some of the story that we don't already know.
Yeah. All right, now since you made up the disc and it's not even in front of me about what's on the disc, okay, you had mentioned that on this disc we were just listening to the post-war Tommy Dorsey Band. Why don't we listen to track 14? All right, it has been a while since I've been in the Boulder studio, so. All right. Why don't you describe here a little bit about what you found from 1941?
Yes, this is the 1941 Coca-Cola Spotlight Bands show. And the 41 band featured the vocal group The Pied Pipers, Joe Stafford, Connie Haynes, and, of course, Frank Sinatra. And I believe track 14 will be Embraceable You. Is that right, Dave?
Yes, it is, with Joe Stafford and The Pied Pipers. Now, let's not forget who the drummer was. Of course, that was Buddy Rich, and Ziggy Elman on trumpet, and really a top-flight group of musicians in Tommy's band. And it says this is from December 20th, so right around Christmas time of 1941.
The Golden Spotlight salutes the champion. Tonight we take the tabulations of our latest weekly Spotlight retail record sales survey, draw a line beneath the figures, add them up, and the total reads Tommy Dorsey. Reports from retail record dealers and jukebox operators throughout the 48 states tell the thrilling story of the meteoric rise of one record from the many made by bands throughout the land. And here we stand ready to pay our spotlight tribute to the man and the band that made the championship record. We're ready to tell Tommy Dorsey his musical good fortune by crossing his palm with silver in the form of a shining silver symbol of Spotlight's success. A replica of the championship platter itself. So, step up, Tommy, and meet your first Spotlight silver platter.
Thank you, Gil. I did have a few appropriate words of thanks written on a shirt cuff. The shirt went to the laundry, and that sort of sends my speech to the cleaners. All I can say now is thanks again, and just by way of showing you that all we need is a little encouragement, here's a tune that we're sending out to bring us back the next silver platter. We've got everything on our side because George Gershwin wrote the tune, and Joe Stafford and the Pied Pipers do the vocalizing. We hope you like our new record version of Embraceable You.
Spotlight points with pride.
And tonight our prideful pointer of light leaps eastward out of the warmth of California into and through the sifting snowflake, cutting the clouds on a journey to the city of Philadelphia. Then passing its entrance exam with a shimmering sweep, the spotlight goes to college, to the University of Pennsylvania, to bestow tonight's spotlight scholarship on one of the greatest non-professional theatrical organizations in the world, the Mask and Wig Club, founded in 1889 and found shortly after by theatergoers to be productive of fine songs, sparkling stories, and talented performers. And for its 54th time out, the Mask and Wig played proud parent as on November 22nd, Into This World was born, the current Mask and Wig production, Out of This World. And now out steps a young man to salute the efforts of the class of 42. It's Tommy Dorsey, paying tribute to the Mask and Wig, its presentation, Out of This World, playing this spotlight tribute to the tune of a sprightly song from the show's score, as Connie Haynes sings the praises of that solid old man.
Thank you. rocking shoes, stealing, jumping, swing afternoon. He's rocking the place with a washboard blues. That solid old man is here again, breaking my eardrums, a beating out. The hip chick stomping, just hit them shy, bringing them down and round about. That solid old man is here again. Tell me I'm tall and call me shorty. The solid old man is double. Whatever you do, won't you do it soon? He drives me crazy, just like the moon. I really can't recognize the tune. That solid old man is here again. That solid old man is here again.
Brian, you did it again. Actually, a tune I'd never even heard of.
I'm so happy.
It's about 9:40. I should, for those of you who are just tuning in, we're talking about the wonderful addition to the University of Colorado of a huge collection that they're just going through of Tommy Dorsey memorabilia. And my guests are Tom Reese and Brian Casey, and my A number one friend, Barbara Dorsey. So, Barbara, you were talking about knowing Connie Haynes, who was the vocalist on that last piece. Remember, she was just 16 when we heard her there, but you knew her a little later than that.
Well, I met her a little later than that, and we were down at Matt Domner's parties that in Florida, and she always came, and one night she said, come on over to the house and let's have cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. And it was just delightful to be with her. It was, I don't know what you say. It was very touching and emotional.
Well, she really had a sweetness about her that I think was very genuine. She just kind of exuded that kind of personality.
Yeah, she really did, and just a delightful person, and it was such fun. Well, see, now that you said that she was 16 on that, I don't know how old my husband was, but when we got together, she gave him a big hug, and I wasn't jealous.
Oh, but you are now?
No. Too late now.
So, Brian, give our listeners some idea of what you're going through, what you're seeing in this collection.
Sure. Well, standing back, the overview is there are 46 boxes, sizable boxes of a variety of materials from this collector, like banker's boxes.
Okay.
And there are hundreds of 78s, hundreds of LPs, hundreds of CDs, and DVDs used as archival material. There are also some of the original 16-inch transcription discs that were the what the radio stations used to prove that they actually broadcast what they were being paid by the sponsors to broadcast. And I believe, at least in the early 40s, Tommy Dorsey was an old gold artist, whereas Chesterfield was associated
with Glenn Miller.
Exactly.
Miller, yes.
But some of the most interesting things that I've found, there are actually still some table cards from different venues in the East Coast, and I wish I had remembered some of them. But there are also movie posters, promotional items. There are copies of contracts for recording sessions, mm-hmm. with band members' names, with the leadership, the producer, all the production information. And there's so much that I still haven't gone through that I'm about 2/3 of the way through this collection. So I have 13 boxes left. And that's been the bulk of my work in the archives since January. It's just been on this one collection.
You do realize how green I am over here.
Oh, I know. I know. And I realize how fortunate I am to be able to do this on a daily basis, to be able to work with this material and log it. And for my own research interests, I'm able to kind of find things that I didn't know existed.
That's wonderful. Tom, my understanding of the collection for listeners of this program, not only, of course, the Glenn Miller Archive, Tommy Dorsey. Talk a little bit about Artie Shaw and how that became a part of this effort.
Again, I believe, and I haven't done my homework on this, so I should have, but I believe it was yet another collector who knew Artie Shaw directly or who had been a long-term collector. Do you know anything about the Artie Shaw materials,
I don't,
Brian?
No.
I think it's maybe not quite as... Quite as extensive as either the Miller or the Dorsey materials, but these things come to us in interesting ways. Very often it is either a friend or a relative who has this material and they want, for good reason, to preserve the legacy of their famous person or musician that they've come to know and love, or in the case of the Walter Scott collection, materials that let's say a fan has systematically collected over the years. On the Artie Shaw materials, again, I don't have. Do we have even a collection description of the Artie Shaw materials?
I don't believe so. I was going to put a quick plug in for the Walter C. Scott collection. There is a summary page on the AMRC website that your listeners could go to at colorado.edu/AMRC. That'll get them to all of the collections within the entire center.
Thank you, Brian. That was an excellent plug, because that's something I have my students do as well. And you can find all of these, just go to collections under the American Music Research Center, and they're listed by the donor. This is sometimes a challenge, of course, because the donor is probably not as important or as famous as the individual. And that's why there's also exciting treasures to be found. These are literally unknown treasures in some cases, because if Jane Roe or John Doe gave us the collection, but it has rare items from very, very famous individuals, those might just pop up. And I could give lots of personal examples of collections that are not in the AMRC, but my own research. And I did want to pick up on one thing that Brian said, and that is, and I think you were saying you were green about this. It is truly exciting
to turn over
pages, and you think, okay, I've seen this. And then, in my case, I saw a Ma Rainey contract for the vaudeville circuits in the 1920s, not in our collections, but when I was going through a small public library archive in Georgia. And again, you feel like you've just walked into history. With how much they were paid, how much more she was paid, how extensive her band was. And so suddenly, it's more than a name. You thought, wow, this was a big person. She commanded this kind of contract. This was on one of the great black circuits,
absolutely,
theater circuits, et cetera, et cetera. So it just fills out. It's like seeing the person live as opposed to just a photograph or a drawing of them. That's why we all become, I think, music researchers. And there's lots and lots of that material.
And there's also Perry Como.
Perry Como. Oh, that's a wonderful story there. And again, our archivist at the time, Cassandra Volpe, came to me one day. And Cassandra had been at the university for many years, a good friend of Alan's, and had been very devoted to his work with Glenn Miller. And I'm not sure of the connection, although Cassandra and, Nick Perito, who was a close associate of Perry's, one of his regular conductors, one of the people who organized his materials, met up at a club on a golf course somewhere in Denver, I believe. Mm-hmm. And natural conversation. Nick Perito, what are you doing? Oh, how do you do, Mr. Perito? What are you doing here? Well, I used to work for Perry Como. Oh, how interesting. And Cassandra says, well, I work for the American Music Research Center. Well, interestingly, Mr. Como was trying to clear out his offices in New York. He's retired to Florida, and he was just trying to downsize, as we all do at some point in our lives. I will eventually. So, of course, the conversation was struck. And as soon as, you know, Alan heard about it, I heard about it, we said, this sounds like a great idea. 40 shipping boxes, not 40 banker's boxes or library boxes, but 40 shipping boxes of Perry Como's materials, including the complete scripts and scores for the 1959, 62 Christmas specials, along with the notations like cut this part, don't do this, go faster. You could literally roll it out. We could hand this out to the participants and you could recreate these shows. Many of his awards, things that, you know, of course, famous individuals receive various kinds of certificates and plaques. I think we had a whole box full of just Perry's, you know, these beautiful Emmys or whatever he had, you know, won over the years. I never met Perry. He died not too long after this, but he had already moved down to Florida. And when we did, I actually brought on my assistant, who's now been here 6 years. We had a Perry Como event, and we were able to discover, again, this, you don't have to scratch too much and you find the connections, as you were saying, women who remembered, who had gotten together in Boulder, some of his original singers for his band, and told some remarkable stories about going with Perry to Cuba just at the time of the missile crisis.
Oh my.
Exactly. Oh my.
Oh my.
And these ladies had apparently had a regular reunion. These singers had come together, and so they stood across, you know, on campus in Old Main, and told wonderful stories about their experiences singing with the band and the strange political situation of the 1960s. And again, you were suddenly right there with this experience, knowing that these three women had performed in the backup band for Perry. Who would have thought when we got this material that we would be able to recreate such a lively event?
Wonderful. Well, speaking of vocalists and one of Perry's competitors from the 1940s and 50s, we're going to listen now to a vocalist I think you'll recognize singing with Tommy's band.
Yes, there's two sides to every story, and there's two sides to every record. And here's the song that's on the other side of Embraceable You. It's Frank Sinatra singing Sunshine of Your Smile.
The world would be. I know no light above that could replace love's radiant sunshine in your dear face. Give me your smile, the love light in your eyes. Life could not hold. Fairer paradise.
Maybe you've seen the latest full-length portraits of Santa Claus in many of the current magazines and big-size enlargements outdoors on the poster board. Busiest man in the world, there he is. Typical of busy, hard-working, active people everywhere, enjoying the pause that refreshes with a frosty bottle of Coca-Cola. Yes, sir, old Santa could tell you it's one of the most all-around pleasant moments a busy man ever met, offering at this busy season of Christmas preparation everything your thirst could ask for. Ice-cold Coca-Cola. It's the real thing. You know, folks, our good friend Mr. Webster says an echo is the repetition of a sound caused by reflection. So tonight, after much reflection, we've decided you'd like to hear the repetition of a series of sounds that still echo in jukeboxes and phonographs throughout the land. It's an arrangement that appeared on one of Tommy Dorsey's biggest records, and Joe Stafford and Cy Oliver are here to sing it for you. Yes, indeed.
When it hits you,
yes, indeed.
Yes, 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 you shall. When it hits you,
yes, indeed.
When the spirit moves you, you shout hallelujah.
I mean,
when it hits you, you holler.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
It comes out if it's in you. Yes, indeed.
Yes. When the dice start jumping, you shout,
let me in there.
Well, all right.
Well, I'll reach.
When it hits you, you holler.
Yes, indeed.
Yes,
that was a very of course that was a very big hit for Tommy Dorsey, Yes Indeed, with Cy Oliver and Joe Stafford doing the vocals. We are at the end of our hour, believe it or not, but Tom, very briefly, if someone wants to explore the materials, can you give them an idea of how to do so?
Yes, this is what we do. The American Music Research Center has a website in the College of Music at the university, and when you get to the header, the home page, if you click on the, I think it's the far left side, mm-hmm. under the word collections, and what will come up is a list of these 80 plus collections by name, and by clicking on individual names, you can discover what is there. It's a kind of a fun exploratory experience. If you then get to that point, you will find descriptions of the collections, and if one wants to actually visit the AMRC, you do this through making an appointment at Special Collections and Archives, which is on the third floor of the Norland Library, the main library of the university. And those people will call you, and you can contact them, and they will be happy to set up an appointment time for you.
Thank you. And I can't tell you what fun this has been. It's wonderful to have you all on my show, and I hope this isn't the last time. My thanks very much to Tom Reese, Brian Casey, and Barbara Dorsey for joining me this evening for Swing Shift, and we'll get back to a more usual Swing Shift, but I certainly hope you enjoyed tonight's broadcast. And next up, as we approach the 10 o'clock hour, I better do this first. It is KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, and it is 10 o'clock, which means it's time for my good friend Dave and jazz.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Jazz Lives. My name is David. I'll be with you until midnight. I have some great tunes for you that I hope you'll enjoy. So relax, stay comfortable, stay cool tonight, and stay in love with KGNU.